So what I want to do today, aside from trying to get us through as much in the current as we can so that we can start next week clean, I want to try and re-emphasize the point. It's actually sort of a new methodological point for me also. I'm interested in how it will play out. Distinguishing between, let's go back. Rilifenstein has the famous distinction between something that you can say emerges from the Rishonim and something you can say is under the authority of the Rishonim. And it's something that emerges from the Rishonim is a reasonable, or is a conceptual implication of what they said that they might or might not have conceived of themselves. And particularly if you want to say that halacha, so if you understand halacha, as we mentioned earlier, halacha often functions case by case. So the fact that the most likely conceptual implication of a particular position is X, and that would lead to nafkamina Y and Z, doesn't mean that the original intended that at all. They just ruled that way in this case. If you had shown them the implications, they might have come to that half distinction. They might have said, well, you know what, that's one possible explanation of how I got to it. But thinking, looking at the implications, I might say, you know what, I would rather ground this decision on something else. Because you can often see how two different people come to the same decision for different grounds. So the most likely ground of the decision is not necessarily the ground that they would take responsibility for. Right? Just imagine concurrent opinions in the Supreme Court. Right? Everyone gets to the same position on different bases. I'm trying to make a, right, and that was in that I look to make the distinction among other places that they can start set this right ahead, as a way of legitimating a longest methodology that is not intensely focused on what we might call original intent. I'm trying to make a somewhat different but parallel methodological point here, which is to distinguish between, trying to see if we can distinguish between the point that the Rishonim are really, really committed to, and the point, what I'm calling an Archimedean point, meaning that's the thing that you would really have to shake them to make them change that. And those things which seem to them to be the most likely outcome based on the intersection of the Archimedean point, whatever evidence you bring. But if you changed it, right, if you changed it, wouldn't really, if you said, yeah, that's not so good, I'd say, okay, yeah, right. Yeah, that just seems to be the most reasonable position, but I'm not committed to it. So as an example, in the Rabbah Kanan, so I tried to argue, and you all argued pretty much spontaneously, that Rabbah Kanan has a really deep commitment to the notion that the Nedama Chavirot are mutual Torah, and you're not going to change that. Right? You're not going to change that. Right? You're going to play, if you throw all the evidence in the world at him, he's just going to play defense. And as long as that position can survive, it's pretty much okay. I didn't describe that when I used to have one of those conversations I loved with Yudhiyah Burzan. So basically, I play defense. Right, he takes our positions, and then he tries to throw everything. He tries to throw Kalatura at me, and if my position survived, that was okay. My position was built on reading particular texts, and everything else, that's great. Everything else, pretty much, my job was to distinguish. Along the lines of a kind saying, I know it's just as good as it. So the planet really committed to that position. So then, when we left the test, the argument I wanted to make is that what drives Tosfos is a conviction that if you associate the Heter of Ate Plata with the statement of Rabbi Baruch Huda that Kol Milta the Amr Da'afe Swasa, Lest they should wish to Gisha, the Tosfos position is that the conjunction of those two pieces of evidence means that Rabbi Baruch Huda must be talking about the original speaker. Okay? Yes, good, thank you. All right, so Tosfos says that Rabbi Baruch Huda makes a statement. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yossi's statement, the Olam Lo Marti Devar V'Chasadis Zachorti L'Achorai, is relevant to that statement. Okay. Put that two together, and Tosfos has an exegetical commitment to the position that Rabbi Baruch Huda is talking about the original speaker. That's what that's for.
Okay.
Okay? As opposed to, Celsus has a conceptual commitment that that's what the Hefter should be. Right? What drives Celsus there is his belief that that's the proper way to understand the text. So the question is, let's suppose we find another person, as we do, let's say the Rambam. And the Rambam says that it's not talking about the original speaker at all. It's talking about the person, it's talking about the people to whom it was spoken. Okay, where the Shulchan. So we could claim, oh look, there's a machlokes between the Tosfos and the Rambam. And the Machlokes, right, as to whether this text should be read as being about the original speaker or being about the secondary speakers, that must be because Tosfos can conceive of it. Right, Tosfos has no difficulty with it being perfectly mutter to say things in front of three people, but for all that's inconceivable. And we can build universes off that. But the truth is, Tosfos has no commitment to that at all. Now, we don't know that Tosfos has an exegetical commitment. That if you put those two pieces of evidence together, that's the way to understand the text. If you were to show Tosfos, by the way, let's suppose you show Tosfos Megirsa in which Rabbi Yossi's statement is unrelated to Rav Baruch Hu. That doesn't disprove his reading. But Tosfos might change anyway. Because he doesn't have a conceptual commitment to it. He just has an exegetical commitment to it. Yes, sir.
How can you tell which one is his commitment? Maybe if it's committed to the idea of it saying things directly to people.
It could be.
Committed to the opposite of that and everything else.
Okay, right, so this is a delicate reading. The Tosfos tells you, and what actually says, that it did the Perek, right, which seems to me, right, that means that he's telling you that his reading emerges from that.
How can you tell if the reading emerges from the reading?
Yeah, it's actually that's what the language says. We have to look at parallel tests and see if he demonstrates, but it's just the question of how the language feels. He doesn't mention anything else.
It tells us where to say
something like, you know, and that makes sense, because why should it be up there? Right? Or some kind of statement which tells me which the right word, or if he says, you know, that some people want to say this, that doesn't make any sense to me, because how can you consider what's right? Yeah, that's it, right? That would be a conceptual commitment. So the question that's going to come up with halacha is, right, so what happens, right, if it turns out that we think that what drove Tosfos was the girsa that we find uncompelling, right. If Tosfos were conceptually committed to this position, we'd say, okay, so there's less evidence, but at least his weight is still behind it. But if Tosfos' whole position is based on that text, and he would be perfectly happy, right, then you can say, you know what, guess what? If Tosfos were aware of the alternative Girsa, he wouldn't talk to him that way either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes.
Do you mind just going through what the difference is of what we have?
I haven't done that yet. I'll just add this. I won't tip off if the Tosfos claims that those two statements are connected, and there are certainly here in which those two statements are not connected.
Okay. Are we going to do that?
Yes. The next unit 2B is the Gemara Arachin, right?
Okay.
And we go through about trying, as opposed to presenting the text to you up front, because the truth is that we don't have that much variability. We don't have as much variability in manuscript as we do in Rishonim.
Okay.
So I'm presenting it through Rishonim. If you want afterwards, I haven't printed them out, but I can print out all the manuscripts for you. And you'll see there's almost nothing in manuscript that isn't in Rishonim, and there's stuff in Rishonim that isn't in the manuscript. So it's easy to do it this way. Yes.
This post-book, exegetical experiment that comes into text, is it better than a conceptual experiment than we written Rambam?
I know it's better. I'm just, all I'm trying to is where he comes from. And it's important to distinguish between... In general, I say it like this. People who come up with ideas that are in tension with the text, that they have to defend against text, that tells you that the idea is their starting point. Right? People who just say things from text and want to go back and forth, right, depending on which way they agree with the text, right, or depending on the girsa, That tells you they're not committed to the idea. They're just committed to the reading. Okay, and that may have impact on how well fellow, especially if their reading is based on a, gift issue. But in general, in terms of, like, if what we say is, and this is part of, this goes back to the earlier term, one mode of stock is to sort of pick up, right, is to sort of pick, take a stance. And that's why I represented the reduction of substance. I'm showing you that the reduction of substance's reading of lots of tests depends on a stance. Mm-hmm. And the reduction stance is that the big three are the big three, and you can't make new speech comparable. You can't make new speech comparable to the big three. Mm-hmm. So, right, on the other hand, Tosus seems to be willing to take the stance of one off. Right, so the starting point of the Rebush is, right, is that no matter what you throw at him, he's not going to believe that Lashon Hara is going out for even if you threw 30 texts, and it's easy to throw 30 texts at you, which demonstrated Lashon Hara, right, because all over Shas, all over the big literature, there are many, many statements that say Lashon Hara is like murder. Right? None of that will move the Rebush in the slightest. They'll just look at you and say, well, the same people know that that's hyperbole. Right, so, right, so like that's it, right. So you can say if you possibly like the Rebush, that means that you have a resistance to giving Lashon Hara anything more than a specific amount of halachic weight.
And is it possible to have a balance between commitment and
sure. And I think that, you know, that when you actually come to the goal, right, you have to figure out, you know, you have to be shaped by evidence, right? You don't want to be, right. You can't, there are people on certain issues, but you want to limit the number of issues on which you are impervious to textual arguments. Right? You know, at that point, you know, at that point you're just legislating yourself. There are, and you have to figure out where they come from. Like, it may be that there are, even what I'm talking about is an unshakable commitment, probably comes from exegesis of some other text somewhere else. Right? You know, you just, you know, there was some Gemara that your sixth grade rabbi taught you that has always been in your head, and that's how you built, and you built your whole religious worldview around that. And if you were to give that up, so then so much else about your religious conception would change that you might as well just not get started. Mm-hmm. Right, everyone has, do you all know what I mean by non-Canadian points? Okay, yeah, okay. Right, everyone has those points. Good. Okay. Archimedes is demonstrating the principle of the lever. And what he said was that he could move the world with a lever long enough, all you need is a point outside the world that you can, right, that you can use as a fulcrum. Right, so Archimedes' point is a point outside the frame of reference that is not affected by the frame of reference. Okay, so, and everybody has those obstacles, right? You know, I don't think there are people whose religious attitudes are so malleable that anything could change, you know, that, you know, right now I think that, you know, the core of Judaism is that halakha is binding. But who knows, you know, if someone turns up somewhere an obscure statement of Sadegon saying that after all the position, right, after, you know, in fact, if 6 million Jews were killed at some point in history, that would break the covenant. I mean, that's what we're saying, right? You know, if I would just change my position, look, here's an authoritative text that says it. I know, you know, this is right, you know, it would take a lot. I think a lot, and I don't know what I would do. It would shatter the whole idea that I built. Everyone has those points, more or less, on different kinds of issues. That's a really broad issue. And then you've got narrow issues. People have their strong preconceptions, right? They're the ones which are easily alterable, and the evidence are the ones they're going to stick to unless you can really, really prove it. Right? So what I'm suggesting here is that Tosfos doesn't, so far as we can tell, have overwhelming conviction about that issue. He does have, he does have a commitment to the notion, sort of a practical commitment to the notion that Chavrus HaChavrus should work with one person. Right, that seems to be something that he, right, he didn't get that out of any text. We know that because we read all the texts. That seems, right, it's possible, as everything is, that just comes out of the language. Right, it says singular. Right, Chavrus, but it also may be that he comes to the text with an understanding of how the world functions. in the same way that I came to Rambam with my experience of what is wrong about Lashon Hara, and so I had deep trouble saying that Lashon Hara is not as great. Lashon Hara is only about spreading information as opposed to its effect on your character. I had lots of trouble with that because it doesn't conform to my own religious experience about what's damaging about it. Right now, you could move me on that because right now, watch, right? Because I have a moral religious commitment to the idea that it's wrong to just spend your time saying nasty things about people, even if you already know them. But I don't have a moral commitment to that being the meaning of the term Lashon Hara. So you could move me, right? You could convince me on purely textual grounds that guess what? That's not Lashon Hara. It's usher because it's an asher. Right? It's usher because, right? So there are things you can move me on. Right? You have a very, very hard time to convince me that there's nothing wrong with repeating it because I have a religious commitment to it. Not the right commitment that's not Lashon Hara because I don't have any intellectual commitment to identifying those categories.
So
my opinion point for this purpose is that it's wrong to just spend your time repeating nasty things about people that everybody knows. But it's not a deep textual point where I say, you know, I don't want that text to mean anything else. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you were, let's say, you know, if you were to try to convince me that McDowell isn't at all about language, right? Even though I don't have a really strong commitment to the notion of natural language, absent the text, I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea that language is perfect up to the early conventional. I don't get bothered at all. I don't have a vascular religious difficulty with that notion, and I'm fine if language is perfectly conventional. But I have a real commitment to that textual reading. Right? The author writes, if you were to try to show me based on other texts that Judaism doesn't believe in natural language, my response is that can't be because McDowell obviously means that. And to say that, right, seems to right, means that you don't have a place for McDowell in your canon. And if it would only be a textual argument, if you had a better reading of McDowell, you show me other examples, I think someone made the argument, you know what? Sometimes Tanakh just likes repeating words in the same way even though they're meaningless. Right, Tanakh likes the pun. Professor Bernstein is fond of Ayurayu Hashem Aspesh Lekalamayim. Right, God is just playing hot tree. Right, he throws a tree, he throws the water. That's why I said by Uray as opposed to by Yahweh. Right, so you can imagine throwing as opposed to pointing out the tree. And it's by Uray or by Ashley. That brings a very good example of, you know, to address the question, are there meaningless puns in turn? Just for fun. Right, so if you're convinced by that and you think that there are meaningless puns in Torah, you might argue, okay, well, you know, living now the Avin, that's just one of those types of language that are the, Kishud HaLashon, right? The kind of things that the old Spaniards would have been very happy with and they always annoy me. Yes?
Just back to your example of their textual versus intellectual commitment to Lashon Hara. Chiro just said Lashon Hara. You don't think that you also have a textual commitment as well because for sociological reasons? If you tell people that, you know, saying bad things about people is also because it's
I have a particular textual reading. Am I comfortable saying things that are effective religiously even if I don't believe them?
Okay.
I generally not, so I wouldn't have. But I might do things like Rebush and say that it's usher to say it's not Lashon Hara. You shouldn't say it's Lashon Hara. Okay. So right then, so what I'm reading is Lashon Hara, what I want to suggest is that in Lashon Hara specifically, and perhaps in almost over the Dhamma Chaviro, these kinds of stances have real significance. Because if you take Rebbe Chanan's perspective that they're all material to all, and you take my argument that the Tu'elet can never be formally defined, or at least is never necessarily formally defined in advance, if you take the position it's mutual Tu'elet, and you take the position that the Tu'elet, in some sense, you have the discretion as to what kind, what degree of toilet is necessary to create better, as opposed to reading the fund formally and saying that any time there's any toilet, it becomes litter. Right, we see ourselves as trying to create standards which we say there's a sufficient toilet in not there. Just like I argue we have to say that it can't be any amount of toilet is not there, any user of mamon. There has to be some kind of proportionality. So then, the different stances of the Rebbe tells us as to how what kind of halakhic significance to give Lashon Hara has tremendous impact on halakha. It's important, right? Because for Tosfos, for example, the toilet, the saving your life, is not enough. Perhaps. And for Rebbe, that's crazy. And what could be more than toilet than saving your life? In fact, if Tosfos holds with the Yerei Meliavor, and then you have to figure out how does that process coexist with Rav Elchanan that says Rav Elchanan says it's much of a toilet, because why isn't that? And we have to come up with whole new conceptual realms that there's a difference between that the toilet of saving your life is overridden by the toilet of Kiddush Hashem, and they, right? And it gets much, much fancier as opposed to reductively just to, like, what's the issue of the toilet of saving your life? Okay. So as we read through the Rishonim, what I'm hoping to emerge out of the Sugya of Apeslasa is not just with a range of understanding of the term and what the possible textual options are in understanding Rambam and Rav Huna, but secondarily with a range of options as to how one conceives of Lashon Hara. I never really gave you, right, I gave you, one model is that it's about torts, and one model that it's about privacy, right, and one model that it's about impact, and one model that it's about virtue, right, so just for starters, right, I'm giving that kind of share, right? We have three models, right, we have the model of Lashon Hara is about damage to the other, we have the model of Lashon Hara is about damage to the self, and we have the model that Lashon Hara is about privacy, which is not the same thing as actual damage. So I can develop those models, but I also want to see if I can get a sense of who and to what degree are Rishonim committed to those kinds of models. Or they can write, and if it's right, or committed to particular readings, so that when I weigh their authority. Okay. So that's where I was arguing the things that seem Tosfos's starting point are A, that's what the text means because of that piece of evidence, and B, that it seems to him that Chavra de Chavra should ordinarily work with one person as well as three. That may be a practical commitment or it may be a textual commitment. And then the rest of Tosfos's position develops from those starting points. Now the Shilta, one thing we can say, I think, is that the Shilta, he doesn't have a starting point that all negative information is always problematic. Now, that's not his starting point. It seems to me that his starting point is likely that Lashon Hara is somehow about privacy. Right? So it's not the most obvious way to read this text. Right? The danger of the Shilta is we don't have the Shilta reading our Sugya. What we have is the Shilta reading the statement of Rav Baruch Huna in isolation and citing it. Right? So you have to be, right? That's why it matters whether the Shilta is a commentary on the Talmud. Right, because the Shulchan, the commentator of Talmud, tells us, okay, you must have read the Sugya this way, and we can evaluate it that way. If the Shulchan is pre-Talmudic, then he doesn't know the Rav Huna in isolation. Right, maybe he's reading the Sugya, right? But in any case, we only know he's reading the Sugya in Arachim, as opposed to the Sugya in the Mubasha. So you can say that what emerges is a conception of Lashon Hara that seems to be based on privacy, but we don't know where that is. That conception a priori doesn't emerge in a sometimes textual reading because we don't have a sense of the background of the Shilta. The theory I'm suggesting is, it makes me figure out this. There's also a question in Halakha: if you have a series of people in the same school, And I do say I have the Rashba, I have the Ramban, Rashba, and Ritva against the Rambam and the Ravid. What do we say? Oh, what I have is Spain, right? What I have is Spain against France and Toulon. So one of the things I'm trying to suggest is that Saliri has certain kinds of choices, and you have to figure out what kind of choices he's making. And it may just, you know, his default setting interpretationally, I tend to think, is very simplistic, even though he's in Toulon, that's a very, that becomes a complicated question. But I tend to think that as a Parshan, right, really, he comes out of this tradition. Now, the Rambam, and yet, now I'm not doing this chronologically, so you have to be, like, for example, I did the Rinnegash last, and I'm writing around them earlier, the Rambam at least conceives of himself as emerging as a Rinnegash in the Rif. So in terms of the, right, so you have to figure out for yourself whether this kind of historical context matters to you or not. Right, I think it matters, certainly matters to me in terms of understanding, right, how much it matters in terms of weight. You know, it depends on who you think the person is. You know, somebody you think is really independent. Well, see, if I think that it's true that the Ritzel comes from the school of Rabban and Rashba, but this is a really independent thinker, and when he, you know, and he wasn't constrained that way, that's what he thought. Right? You know, he was convinced as opposed to he was just following right by Nike more authority to it. I don't actually know anything about the Ritzel, so it doesn't. I can't tell you much about that at all. But all those are factors you can consider. Okay, the Rambam comes along, and the question I'm asking is, where do you think the Rambam is coming from? Right. What drives the Rambam's understanding? It's hard to know, because the Rambam is in the commentary. And he doesn't tell you how he read the text. He doesn't tell you explicitly which text he's coming from. But I would suggest that, you know, the Rambam didn't really consider the possibility that anything said in front of three people is mutter. But, you know, that probably, I would do it. But the other argument is that how could publicizing information more make it less often. And that may be, because it all starts with the conception that what's wrong about Lashon Hara is that he defined Lashon Hara. Right? I have an issue before we got to anything. I said Lashon Hara is spreading information about people. And so the position that Tosfos seems to think Tosfos derives textually is the Rambam impossible. Yes,
ma'am. And why is he allowed to read it here, repeat it?
When you're not spreading information.
But if his concern is getting spread in.
It doesn't spread it.
How is repeating it not spread?
Repeating it to each other. Everyone already knows it. That's how he defined it. I have problems with this outcome. I think it's plausible to say the Rambam comes with a concept, right, a definition. Lashon Hara is letting people know bad things about people that they didn't previously know. And that, right, that makes it impossible for him to read El Barfun as being about the original speaker. But it makes it possible for him to reach an inclusion that bothers me to end, which is that it's okay to keep repeating things that people already know. Now, what is it 3 and 2? So the Rambam doesn't have an answer, at least from here, of if you said it to one person, who you can say it back and forth as often as you want. It's just if it's said in front of three people, right? If it's said in front of three people, then you can say it to other people on the assumption they already know it.
He makes that assumption?
In the Siparat Tavar, to anybody, I think the most plausible reading. Now, if you think that's impossible, right, that Rama would have, right, that it would ever be mutter to say Lashon Hara to somebody who you didn't, of your own knowledge, know already this. And you would interpret that, and you would have read that Rama saying, and then compare the Vara Kadna Shlo Shatama Kheret to one of those three. Right, and that wouldn't be textually driven. Right, that would be driven by your, right, right, by your prior conception of what Lashon Hara is. Right, so I'm suggesting is that the Rambam, right, that Tosfos has no conceptual commitment that we know of in advance. The Shulta has a conceptual commitment that there's the wrong and the breach of privacy, which emerges out of the text, and then he's right, and then he's okay with making that what Lashon Hara is about. And the Rambam comes with a very definite conception, albeit one that I find challenging. Yes, Aaron and Jesse.
I guess, you know, sort of like, how can Lashon Hara ever be about the people hearing it, if they're the ones who are responsible for a Chavra Chavra
Yisrael? How can Lashon Hara ever be about the people hearing it?
Like, how would you use the definition be for those listening if one of the justifications that we had from the Gemara and Erechim, which they haven't totally gone through yet, is the reason why it's not Lashon Hara is because Chadra Chadra. And like, they're the only ones who heard, so they're going to be the ones who are then passing it on.
Why are you assuming they're the only ones that heard? If you tell the three people, they're assuming that this is sort of thing that you didn't have any problem with saying, that you probably already said it to someone beforehand.
That could be.
It's only a problem for the first people to hear.
Right, the reasonable summary, anything that you say in front of three people, I know you're going to say everybody you meet. No, so therefore those three people can repeat it, because they're not the ones who are going to spread it, it's the guy who told them was going to spread it.
Okay.
Right, that's what I was going to argue. And at that point, again, this is the question, and since you're going to tell other people that those people are going to spread it, we're not going to, right, then you get an issue whether it becomes winter because to do something because somebody else is going to say that, right? That gets back to there are 10 other people, one of them is going to tell them that they're the one, so why don't I just do it? Yes.
I mean, just to address a little bit what Daniel was talking about in your term, I think the Rambam is a really good example here. You have both a conceptual commitment and a textual commitment.
Yeah.
And as a result of those commitments, you end up with this bizarre arbitrary line of three people, right? Because he conceptually committed to the idea that it's about spreading the word, and he's textually committed to Rambam Arapuna.
Yeah, but that's not a textual commitment to what that means. He's committed to that. He has to interpret that text.
Right? But that means you've got it. So what difference could three people possibly make? And this is what he comes up with.
Right.
So he needs both.
Right. So we should be careful, right? Everybody has to interpret just about every text. Mm-hmm. Right? So they have textual commitments. You know, there are cases where you can tell, like, for example, some people have to interpret, everyone has to interpret the girsa they have. They're not, right, not committed to understanding every girsa. But they may, right, but there's a difference between saying, as Tosfos says, they're committed that this text means that. Right, the Rambam is, I don't know the Rambam is a kid, right, but the Rambam is committed to what the text can't mean. Right, if the text can't mean that, this is the best he comes up with. If somebody else came with something where that would make more sense, he would say, oh, great. Right, I would not be inclined to say, oh, look, my focus is being so-and-so. If somebody came with a reading that Rambam never thought of, and I would have said, oh, you know, I don't, seems likely the Rambam didn't think of that, but you know, if he had been shown that, he would have said yes. Now that's interesting. Yes,
long
as he maintains his commitment. So that's also an interesting commitment. Professor Steiner showed, I think, because this is a need a couple of places, that I gotta refer it this way, that Dr. Soloveitchik was very into the idea that you can trace it, like you can trace the history of ideas into good. It's a total history phenomenon. And you can say, you know what? Wow, nobody thought of this until then. And for the people who didn't say that beforehand, it wasn't that they thought of it and they rejected it. They never thought of it. Right? Once it was thought of, they might have said something differently. Professor Steiner, that I'm always nervous about. Always of the notion that nobody could conceive of something. Although, again, part of what Dr. Soloveitchik is telling you about is why it is that people couldn't have thought of that seriously, and then all of a sudden, at point X in history, it became conceivable to think that there was impossible to think that way. What Professor Steiner showed, in terms of data, really, I guess, background with the revolution for Dr. Soloveitchik is a bit of time. I mean, Tom thinks of things in ways that nobody thought of previously, and you can't speak about previous people being told they've never been in town. It's just the world before they've been in town, right? And the world after, right? People the world before they've been in town are people before you could think of the island splitting. Right? You can't talk about people being, right, pre-20th century figures being Kolig on the possibility of using nuclear weapons. That's just why it wasn't in the universe. So, Dr. Steiner showed, I thought, convincingly historically that in terms of Chat and Scottish, that there are just readings that nobody thought of. And the interesting thing is he showed it specifically in terms of Ramdan's discovery, Rashkan's discovery in Gruzia, that really you can show, like, everyone sees this problem. There's a whole array of possible explanations for it. Rashbam discovered this principle, and you can't find anybody after Rashbam who offered any of the previous readings.
What's the
principle? It's the Mikuzio principle, right? That idea that Shemash has envelope structures where you go 5 or 6 foot away, and then there's a front end without the obvious antecedents. Everybody tries to figure out where does the antecedent go, but if you look at it and say, oh, look, it's the closure of that opening back there, all of a sudden you see, right, the reason in front of the antecedent goes all the way back there, because it's the end of the unit. And there are a whole bunch of places where there's nobody was thinking structurally before Rashbam, apparently, and so they just missed it, and Rashbam comes along, and he says, this refers to that, and then the universe flattens out.
How is no one thinking structurally?
There's certain things, you know, the same way, you know, that people did, you know, I think, like, you know,
Fury.
Right?
Human resistance
of
Fury. Like, for measuring, roughly.
Yeah. There are models of literary thought as well. People don't, you know, people didn't think about puns. Mm-hmm. You know, in certain types of things. Right? The interesting thing is that you thought of Sumatra as a topic by topic thing. And right, you weren't looking at giant things, then the world changed. And the thing, you know, the way that I've argued, the world changed, right, when the science came along, and people didn't think about ideas. People thought about pots and pans, and then they stopped thinking about pots and pans, and they started thinking about platonic pots and pans. I think that's overstated, but right, so there are certain types of categories, certainly 20th century history categories, that nobody would have thought of mattered previously. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I think, you know, in terms of ideas, I'm always nervous about that, but I was convinced by Professor Steiner that it happens in terms of readings. Right? So our readings would come along that just no one saw before, and no one could see them, and say, well, that's true. Mm-hmm. So again, so here, I think if somebody told another way of reading the Sefer HaZohar Chai Neshlo Shah that preserves the wrong commitment that made even more sense, he would have said, wow, I don't think it would argue. You can't say, well, Ram was calling on that. He thought about it. No, he didn't tell it a better way. If somebody came up a better way, he would have been in the Trinity section. Because he understands, like, this, you know, maybe he understands that this isn't such a great idea. And then right, he says, well, who's going to stop him? This seems to undermine, well, what, you know, what he's saying, and then, right, you know, but generally they can put it together. Okay, that brings us to Mary Gershon. Okay, so Jonathan said directly yesterday, the move that Rabbi Gershon makes. Now here we have to be careful what I'm doing pedagogically, right? Because I'm not presenting chronologically. So don't start thinking, oh, well, nobody, you know, Rabbi Gershon, nobody thought of this because Rabbi Gershon is the first person. Alright, which is really interesting, right? The Lechai is before Rabbi Gershon, yeah. The Lechai, I don't know if they understood it all. Right? So Rabbi Gershon is much, right, so it's much earlier, you just have to figure out to what degree he had circulation, who had access to him. That's the whole point about the Rivet, and it's the Electric Scholarship that, you know, the Rivet, all of Provence vanishes. Nobody knows anything about anybody from Provence for much of a lot of history, and so, like, the positions of the Rivet that make a lot of sense are not being rejected by everybody else, it's just that nobody ever heard of them, because Provence was wiped out by the Jesuits. So it's one generation, and that is going to be the sense of the hardest necessary. Okay. So Rabbi Gershon says, "Kol nisnosa dinis after dinis amar be'afet klasa, ve'az lehani klasa mishtoi ba'lachrine, Less than Shul Mishnah Gishra. Okay, fine. That is his translation of the Bar Chana. Right? Anything which is said in front of three, there is no Lashon Hara about repeating. Okay, now we always have to be careful whether there's no Lashon Hara about what happens if somebody comes and tells me credibly, this was said to me by so and so in front, in front of two other people. Is it mutter for everybody to repeat anything once this was said in front of three people? Is it mutter only if you were one of the three people? That hasn't been stated at all, and that depends on all the contextual criteria as well. But the irrigation's first level is that less Lashon Mishnah means that there is a Lashon Hara to repeat it. And he goes on, because the Han now means Zavrik Naihu, and this also, the Macha, right, the Gamalu Swami Gadlanahu, right, that is also Lashon Hara. The Yim is Amra Ba'afei Trey, so if the Macha was there kind of two, the Hani Trey Amri Lachmina, and you have those two words to say it to others, then if they Shem Lishkavita, then it would be Lashon Hara to repeat that Macha. Okay, so if you're making this reading of the figure, let's be careful, as we should say. Rabbi Gershon, there's this reading of Rav Baruch Huna, and there's reading of the figure. Rav Baruch Huna's statement is not about Macha. And Rav Baruch Huna's statement is about Lashon Hara. So after the word Mishnah Bisha, he's not commenting on Rabbi Baruch Huna anymore. Now he's reading the sugya. Okay, what he's reading is, the claim that the reason you require three from the Macha is because you hold like Rabbi Baruch Huna. The reason you require three is because, right, is because otherwise repeating a Macha would be Lashon Hara. Okay, now that's a really interesting challenge. So the first question, right, what's the obvious question you have to ask in the Gershon?
To
do what?
To do
Macha. To do Macha?
Well, like, to tell that.
To repeat Macha?
Yes.
Okay, so the first question you have to ask about it is, how could it be usher to repeat the Macha? Isn't that... Right, isn't spreading the word of the Macha really a service?
Yeah.
So then you have to claim, the question you have to ask is, does the Gershon believe it would be us in front of two people to go back and tell it to the Machzik? Right? Or is it only pointed as the us to tell anybody else? And most people are going to be willing to tell the Machzik. Or you can just claim there's a circularity here. Since the Macha in front of two people doesn't work, so it's after to go back and tell the other. Right, if it were to work, then it wouldn't be after because it would be in his best interest. Right, that gets you in a reflexive loop. I would suspect that the easiest way of reading it is that if it were to work, in the front of two, you would just say that you still can't tell a third party because maybe the damage to the Machzik outweighs the gain. But you can tell the Machzik himself. That's going to be easier for reading it, but certainly not a compelling one. So this is a deeper question. Before you even get to that, good. Well, I guess that makes sense.
Well, when you show that the bar denied, it's almost predicated on people telling to do it to the bar denied.
He says that Macha, if we say that Macha is based on Kavra, so this is a really interesting vision of Rangeshan Rajas. Here is something that could be really wrong, But it's so great. But now, once there are three people, not only is they not wrong, but we think it's a good thing. Now, what Egerton doesn't tell you is what the Lashon Hara is if it's said in front of two people. That process seems to be the call you call somebody a thief. Saying either so-and-so is a thief, or that so-and-so called somebody a thief, right? That matters. Whether what's repeating is that so-and-so is a thief, or that so-and-so called somebody a thief. That is something that would be wrong, but once it's said in front of three people, then it's not only they're not wrong, but we kind of build, assume logically at least, that when we praise them or not, when we build the part of the faith, the mitzvah, and the engagement of the same, we seem to count on it. So what are the starting points that the rejection comes from? So we could say that it's truly literary. We could say, you know what, he's just driven by the right, he just looks at you and says, wow, there isn't any, you know, you just look at the figure, and the figure says that Machra depends on Lashon Hara, that must be that because Machra is Lashon Hara. Right, it could just be everything comes from that. But I would suggest that there's a whole bunch of assumptions behind what he's saying. He is, let's start with this. The question I want to ask is as follows. Is it Lashon Hara for me to tell somebody that so-and-so is stealing my land? Not in the context of the Nachal.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a really interesting assumption. It can be Lashon Hara, if you think that's what they're going to say, right? Do you? Right? Now, let me ask the question, if you say it in front of two, is it Lashon Hara for those two to repeat it, or was it Lashon Hara to say it? Right, which one is the mitigation can do it to? Is it a Yeshua committed to the idea that if I am Mocha ineffectively, halakhically, that I have violated Lashon Hara? You want to say something
else? I just think Rabbeinu Gershom is very ambiguous in terms of who is committing Lashon Hara here, and consequently who the, this is what Aaron and I were talking about during who the head there is for. Because, you know, the question is when it says,
the head there is for, he tells you it's 4 to 3, right? Zihaz Zihani Fasa.
Right, but it's unclear whether the Leipa Mishum Rishavish is just on the last clause or is it also on the first clause there. We couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out.
Uh-huh.
Which way it went.
Interesting. I assume that at the very least, that the Negershon has to hold his mutter to make a halakhically effective macha. Right? That's my argument. But every Rishon will believe that it's not a mutter to make a macha in a way that works legally.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. If it's a macha. But even that, the point, it only works legally, apparently, if he, let's assume, like, the three, right?
Right.
It only works legally if you say it's like three people.
Yeah, so if you say it's like two people, he might believe in it's Lashon Hara, or he might not.
Right.
Yeah, that much I agree. But if three people, it's not just most of the people who repeated it, it was most of you to say it.
Yeah.
Okay, Jonathan, what do you want to say?
He never explicitly talks about it, he doesn't have to talk about whether it's most of the original had to say it, because the issue of Gemara that he has to deal with clearly is, why would I need a certain amount of people for the Maha so that it will, you know, the focus of the Gemara is then what happens to the Maha after it leaves the mouth of the Telling.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't actually have to explain what the status is of the Maha on behalf of the Telling. He has to explain what the status would be, when it would be spread, and what implications that would have.
Okay.
We can't actually conclude. There's nothing conclusive in the Menagerson that tells us what he thinks the status of the Maha is when it's said to the 2/3 people.
Okay. Good. Yes, Alicia.
So
Yeah.
It's to me that almost, you know, for whose purpose does it look for? Right, where, you know, for two people, you know, you can take to say it's just the purpose to make a statement. Why? Because it's up to the people. But, you know, with three people have to be that, you know, there's some sort of mechanism that they're allowed to repeat it now because, you know, despite being out of it, like, in the hut, in, what was it, the strategy travel.
Right.
But when the two people, you know, it is an option to repeat it, therefore only, you know, four of them in the benefit of and just saying it.
That's right. I heard, you know, that. A makah for the sake of getting your emotions out doesn't make you want to repeat it. Right? That's true. Okay. Here's, I want to make one other point. The negation is not committed to the question of whether of what happens if the people who hear it know that it's true. The negation is not committed to that either. It might be that the issue here is repeating that so-and-so said that Tanya is a Gazana, right? Because there's no social utility in that at all. Who cares if so-and-so called him a Gazana? Right? Whereas, if I say, right, maybe that if I go to two witnesses and I say, Tanya is a Gazana, and I can prove it, because here is my, right, here, right, here is my star. Or I can prove to you, and I find somewhere the joint brother negative proof that he doesn't have one. Right? If I convince you. Right? Maybe it's not after all either. Right? So not committed at all to my attitude, right, to the attitude of the repeaters, and it might be that that this whole discussion for him is only about the question of whether you can repeat the telling somebody to Makal. But of course, if you know that someone's a goblin, that's fair game. Right, because why should we like a woman? Why should we like a woman get away in society? Okay, so here again, to figure out when you weight positions, right? So you're saying, well, there are eight Rishonim who hold that it's talking about the repeaters, and only two hold it's talking about the original person. Right, or do you go by their conception of Lashon Hara, which may not in any way track, because you can have a concept, right? Because you can have one conception of Lashon Hara which is read this way. Right, there are many, many different ways in which you can parse the authority, and you have to figure out where. If you're the kind of person who decides to talk everyone to some degree on the basis of authority as opposed to what you personally find compelling, you have to figure out what level of authority is, because it may end up that the majority of Rishonim have one conception of Lashon Hara, and yet they read it in a way, right, they read it this way, whereas the majority of Rishonim read the text the other way, and those may not track at all. You have to figure out how that balances. Michael, you have a question?
Mm-hmm.
No? Let me hand up. Yes, Cameron.
So, would you say that Rabbi Gershon was more concerned about the purpose of the Mecca as opposed to the content, or the technicality of how you say it?
I think that Gershon is only interested in Mecca, and not very interested in Lashon Hara at all. That's how it's right. Gershon is interpreting the Sugya in the Lashon, and the Sugya in the Lashon is not about Lashon Hara.
Right.
It's only about Mecca. Rabbi Gershon fundamentally does, as opposed to everybody else who has to really care about Lashon Hara, because we're just making an analogy between Mecca and Lashon Hara, and Rabbi Gershon goes, we don't have to care about Lashon Hara at all. All we have to do is come up with a heter for Mecca. Right? That's all he's trying to do, is come up with a heter for Mecca. He comes up with that, and that's it. Right? So I would suggest all Rabbi Gershon stands for is the literary plausibility of a reading that you can read it that it refers to the others, right? You seem to think that's plausible.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe a textual commitment to the notion that they should be the Makar Lashon Hara should be not an analogy, but a direct, right, but a direct connection. And that means that he's perfectly comfortable with the possibility that something about Makar Lashon Hara, as opposed to a possible position which is that we have such a strong interest in Makkah that any, right, the argument is like this. We say that we can only allow a makah if it wouldn't be Lashon Hara. That's one way of conceiving it. What we say is, it couldn't possibly be Lashon Hara if it was a makah. Now, Rabbi Gershon says that this sugya tells us that we would not allow makah unless it was mutter for Lashon Hara. Right? So he's open to the possibility that there are things that would otherwise be a good idea as makah, or perfectly okay as makah, but we wouldn't allow the makah because of Lashon Hara. Right? So he's not, so he doesn't have an Archimedean point that we have such that the interest of the system is to encourage makah. All right, John, what do you want?
Or it could just be that his starting point is that something won't spread. Something won't spread it, Lashon Hara.
But it's not Lashon Hara, it's makah, right? You can just start.
He assumes that that content would be Lashon Hara, and the only reason it ever spread is because it loses that status. I mean, as long as
that's
the
status
of Lashon Hara, he assumes that it can't spread, and therefore it's
ineffective. That's true. But that's circular. I mean, the thing is that,
true.
Because, right, we decided that Makah was Mutter, it wouldn't be Lashon Hara anymore. Right? I could have made the position, to take the position that Makah is always Mutter, period. Why? Because Lashon Hara is Mutter, Lashon Hara is.
And
Rabbi Gershon's not saying that. And the Gershon says there is something that, right, he's saying that it might, that under ordinary circumstances, maybe, in other words, that's a possible, I think, a problem interpretation of Rabbeinu Gershon is that the Chavra Yisrael works by two people also, sufficiently to let the Makhazik know. Right? If we need to make it up there. But we choose to make it up there. Because then it would be Lashon Hara. Right.
But why would
you
say that?
Because he thinks that, you know, Lashon Hara is a bad thing. I don't know. Or because he thinks that's where the text comes from. You know, it's ironic because, of course, if his goal was to minimize negative information about people, it's counterproductive. Now more people know.
Right.
Right. On the other hand, it might be that what he's saying is this will minimize, right? What we want to do is we want to raise the stakes for people making false makos.
Right.
Okay, yes, sir.
I wonder if maybe what he wants to do is make the Makah Lashon Hara so that when we do finally allow Makah, then we allow it in such a way that minimizes the damage done on it. So that at this point, if word has been spread, it will only spread to the people necessary to.
No, if I care, it's worse. Right? It's counterproductive because before we could have Makah just to two people, and then it would just have spread back to the opposite. But he requires Makah to be so public that everybody hears about it.
No, he requires it.
To be in front of three people.
In front of three people.
So he requires everybody to know about it.
Okay.
All right? So that's the irony. So he may do that in order because he thinks that people are less likely to be mocha falsely that way. Or it may be that he's just not thinking that, you know, it may be that he's just a formalist. And he says, I don't want to be Lashon Hara. This isn't Lashon Hara. And all I care about is whether it meets the formal category of Lashon Hara. And if it turns out that the way one of the interesting thought experiments is, right, you know, you could imagine a pure halakhic formalist saying that we need to wipe out Lashon Hara in our culture. So what we're going to do is make sure that everybody should set up a statement, a way in which everything you say is immediately recorded and Twittered to three people. Right? So that way, we eliminate Lashon Hara in our society because everything that is said is Afei Plasa. Baruch Hashem. All right, so some people will raise the question, maybe that doesn't work. Maybe it has to be in person, right? And that will be the problem with that theory.
And the hiring people to walk into the theory.
That's just right, you know, encourage, right? Right? And so again, so our goal in, let's say, if we're setting up a high school, we want to have a moral high school culture, our goal is to create really tightly bonded cliques. So that nobody has to show them should have to say the Lashon Hara is only one person. That's my point. Right? So you can say that they're going to get some justice formalist. He wants to make sure that Makah doesn't violate the law of Lashon Hara.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that that means that Lashon Hara spreads, that the bad information spreads further doesn't bother him at all.
Mm-hmm.
All he cares about is adding up the Yisurim. Okay, if you have to figure out, right, you know, if you're the formalist can say that, right? Now, I tend not to be a formalist in that way. But you should be aware, right? That there's certainly a way in which one can read it. Yes.
I don't understand why you don't want to say that he has a really, really strong conceptual commitment to the idea that comes from a deep Vajrakara. And the question is, so wait a minute, why is Nihara ever Mutter? And the answer is, well, because we have Rava Barahuna, who tells us that in front of three isn't Lashamara anymore.
Okay, good question. The reason I'm not saying that is because if that were the case, you could interpret the sugya as follows. Anything said in front of three people is not Lashamara, and therefore is Mutter to be Mocha in front of three people. Right, so now the question, right, instead he said anything he said in front of three people is not Lashon Hara for those three people to repeat. Now, so here we get to a good point, okay? Let's watch, right? It may be that the reason he says that is because he thinks that Chavris Bechavri is played them, but I'm not sure why. He can say the reason is Mutter to say it in front of three people.
Look, he doesn't talk about the mechanism ever. It's unclear why. We do not know why he thinks.
That's true.
In front of three people, we have no idea. That could be any of the reasons we've seen or none of them.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's so hard to figure out what he's saying, because
yeah.
We don't really know.
Right. The reason I'm not saying your thing is that would commit me to the position that it's us or to be Mocha in front of two people, as opposed to us or the two people to repeat it.
I'm not entirely convinced that he's not talking about all four people either.
So. Okay, it's possible. Right, but in the end, you say that there are very few, there's very little you can get of integration other than the plausibility of a textual reading. Mm-hmm. Right, so I tend to suspect that that means that he has intellectual weight in the halachic way. Sorry, in a sense. But, okay, so then we went to the Ritza. Okay? So Ritza, right, the Ritza opens up a whole new textual universe. How does Ritza open right explicitly? So what's the textual point Ritza makes that no one else makes explicitly? Yes, then. Right? Who saw this? Who said this already?
The
Shilta, right? So there is this claim that Lashon Hara is it's just the Shilta. So what's the radical thing the Shilta does?
Shilta does,
or
Ritza
does? Sorry, the Ritza does.
It means false.
Right, the radical to Ritza Jake is you don't have to reconcile with a Master and Arupin. Right, that's right. Any attempt at harmony, for example, the whole premise of Tosos was that you have to mean this here because in Arupin, they apply Rodiosi. Right, Ritza says, do what? Right? In Arachin, right, and he's explicitly countering Tosfos. So in Arachin, they say, because of Lashon Hara, demand Amarle, which is what Tosfos says. Right? Tosfos says, because of Rabbi Yossi in Arachin, therefore in Arachin, it has to be of a person who says it. But so what? So Lashon Hara can be about something else entirely. Okay?
I just have to figure out are compatible or if they're talking about two different things.
He doesn't say that it's a machloket hasugya. He says, you know, show us some talk with the Talmud. Right? He's not claiming there's a halachic conflict, but he's claiming there's no reason that the statement of Rabbi Baruch Huna has to mean the same thing in both contexts. Really, there are two statements of Rabbi Baruch Huna. And this one is about secrets, and that one, now what he does is he writes for it, and that means Rishutna is machloket to anybody. Right, you can't claim that the machloket the Shilta says Rav Arjuna is the Daf Gilei Sod, and the Rambam says that Rav Arjuna is about right the Daf Zavar Shel Gedai or right the that no the Shilta is perfectly natural together with Rambam. All the Shilta is telling you is what Rav Arjuna meant in Zavatra, or what Rav Arjuna meant when he was talking in the privacy of his own home, which is against both of Zavatra and Rambam probably now. So the Ritva. The Ritva opens up the space for us, if you want, and he also totally totally messes up the whole halachic system, because now nobody has to argue with anybody. Everybody can agree. At least everybody, right, because unless somebody explicitly tells you what they mean in both of about Ben Arachim, right, you can never prove that anybody disagrees with anybody. Because you might always think it means the other thing in the other place. Right, so this is a, Right, this is an utterly destructive thing if you, what you want is precedent, a liberating thing. But if you don't, because now you just say, okay, I can just, you know, everybody agrees with me, all the people apparently disagree with me are just letting Tom the other cigarette. Okay, yes, Tom.
The question is exactly how he figures that the same statement of Rebel Grover Fuma can be two different things simply by the fact that it's 22 different places. Is that, is he saying that about Rebel Grover Fuma's actual position, that he believes that this has two different, that it has relevance in two different contexts, or is it really the fact that this gets cited in these two different places in different contexts?
So he has his line. Daniel Shana from his Kalkin Batonga. The quick by long search didn't show Ritzah, didn't show him using that phrase anywhere else. But I didn't look at the Ritzah Karasuk of the Rostra.
For Ritzah?
Yeah. So we should probably just take it out and look at the Mahot notes, because I don't have a, right, see if he has other examples of this. He seems to feel, I can show you a figure certainly where the same line in the Talmud means, same line in the Talmud means three different things in the same figure.
In the same figure.
The same line. Not Havani Namaskara. But for literary purposes, they use the same line to mean three different things in the same figure. So it may be, if he has other examples of a Mariah meaning different things, there is a seem to think it's an exegetical purpose that the same statement can either be interpreted as Havani different things, could it mean different things, I don't know which one. Yeah, I don't know which one.
Okay.
I know which one. He might think that there are two positions of the Talmud and only one of them can be right historically, but both of them can be right halacha. I don't know. But as far as, this is a huge space. Now, if you ask me where this problem comes from, this probably comes from the position in opposition of negation, which is that he can't imagine that it's wrong to repeat a machah as such. Right? The only thing that could possibly be wrong is confidentiality. But, I don't know. That's why I meant to recognize with the risk of, that the, Masada Hashlama, of course, is what? As opposed to Rishta, what's the fun of Hashlama? Who? Tell me something, why is Hashlama so much fun after you read the Rishta?
No.
Wait,
Absolutely.
You have to,
right? This thing is obviously about Gilead Sotheth. And this thing is so obviously about Gilead Sotheth that I have to be willing to say that the thing is talking about something else. Whereas the Shemana says that if a this thing is no evidence about Gilead Sotheth, then it has to be about Gilead Sotheth because the other thing is proven.
Right? It's not the exact opposite, but it's so extreme, right, that the Ritzah thinks that there's no way a Rakan can be about Gilead Sotheth. Right? So he has to come with this obvious, right, deep stretch to claim the same thing as two different things, because there's no way to reconcile a Rakan with the notion of Gilead Sotheth. And the Ritzah says it's because of a Rakan it's about Gilead Sotheth. Would suggest, and I didn't do up the Hashmallah from you, and he has a very, very different reading, but I would suggest that it might be that the Ritzah and Hashmallah have such radically different literary sensibilities that this happens, but it's much more likely they have different gears up. It's much more likely that the Ritzah in Arachim has Rabbi Yossi quoted about the Afei Tata. And if it's Rabbi Yossi, then it can't be about Gilead Sotheth, I think. And that the Hashlama, and perhaps that the Ritzah doesn't have the Chabra Yisroel in Arachim, whereas Hashlama has Chabra Yisroel, and doesn't have a DLC. So you think the community is evacuated too. That would be my tentative suggestion, that this is yet another of the Machloket, which depends on Girsa. But it's pure speculation. We don't have either of the Girsa. Well, at least you don't have it here. We can look at Arachim, but there aren't many Rishonim actually have Arachim. We're not going to find the Ashlama on Arachim. So there again, you have to figure out to what degree speculations about yourself affect you and affect the way you do it and begin muscle code. Okay. That's probably all we can do today. So we'll pick up with the Rosh Hashanah on Monday.